Alex DeWall, almost the expert on famine and conflict in the Horn of Africa. He literally wrote not the book, but multiple books on Darfur genocide, warfare in Sudan. I became aware of him as sort of a go-to source of information during the Ethiopian war between 2020 and 2022. And he has come out and said he has never seen anything worse than what is happening in Gaza right now.
Hello, Rob. How have you been this week?
No real complaints. Just thinking about how depressing today's episode is going to be, mostly.
Are you very upset that you've nearly been kicked off YouTube?
Yeah, that doesn't help my general mindset, that's for sure. But it's part of just a larger sort of corruption or warping of public discussion that I think we've seen in the United States. For those who are not following my Instagram, where I complain about this at great length, the More Freedom Foundation Instagram site, I was threatened by YouTube, threatened that my entire livelihood, my entire archive on YouTube would be deleted because of comments that I was making on my own YouTube channel that could be interpreted as
hate speech. Because you were criticizing the second season of The Office. Like, I'm pretty sure they should have not even warned you for that.
I know, right. That's clearly the main focus is of my commentary on YouTube is television criticism, because what's more important, Rory, than the era of peak television? That's not, in fact, what happened. It probably won't surprise you much to hear that what I was discussing that triggered, after a decade of saying very, very controversial things on YouTube, what triggered this advanced scrutiny from YouTube was my speaking honestly, and yes, sometimes quite strongly, about the role of Israel and what Israel has been doing over the past 6 months. And I think we were already intending to do this anyway, but it just underlined how important it is to continue talking about what the U.S. government and the Israeli government is continuing to do in Gaza, which is a horrific crime against humanity that is somehow still going on 6 months later.
It's a Mark Steele joke that in 2022 it wasn't considered controversial or anti-Semitic to think bombing children was a negative thing. But sadly now, if you seem to think that it, you know, isn't the greatest thing to be at, and maybe there's other ways to go after a terrorist organization, then you know, you're not a good person.
Yeah, it's quite alarming, and it's McCarthyite, is what it is. It's quite extraordinary. I think the specific sentiment that I expressed on my YouTube channel that was flagged by YouTube as hate speech was my pointing out that Palestinians are Israelis. And what we're talking about here is not a war. It is a government that has chosen to carry out a program of extermination against members of its own population. One of the great standard lines, standard excuses that you'll hear to excuse Israel's actions here is like, well, what if Mexico fired some missiles into Texas? Quite ludicrously, I think possibly as a politically correct thing, the governor of New York recently changed it up a little bit and said, well, what if Canada had fired some missiles into New York or something along those lines, which I thought was a sort of strange new remix of that old approach. But the fact is that because of very hard work by Benjamin Netanyahu and thousands of other people in the Israeli and U.S. governments, the two-state solution is dead. It is something that never happened. Palestinians are Israelis, and the Israeli government is exterminating them. And I think that's a crucial point of clarity that is obscured. And if you point that out in YouTube comments on your own YouTube channel, you risk being flagged for hate speech. Quite disturbing. To be clear, I'm not really that worried about what this is going to mean for my YouTube channel. I'm definitely probably going to stop mentioning genocide less in my comments, but I'll probably start mentioning genocide more in my content, because I think there is a wider remit for what can be said in content. I mean, who knows? Perhaps I will no longer have a YouTube channel this time next month, but I think that's my operating assumption at this point. But I am going to be more careful in how I respond to comments going forward, because I definitely don't want to end up in YouTube's Kafka-esque, no reprieve kind of system, where some algorithm can tell me whether or not I'm allowed to continue producing, continue doing what I've been doing for a decade.
How deep have you been researching Gaza, keeping up to date? Because I just find it so depressing. Like, I've literally seen one little snippet on a feed the other day, and it was a child who was terrified because there was thunder. So she thought it was Israeli, you know, planes and bombs coming again. And that, it gave me, I couldn't sleep. It gave me like a weird dream where Gaza was in America and it was just constantly being like harassed. So are you getting into the weeds of this? Or are you kind of like, for your own sake, keeping a distance?
Well, I've had a long-standing policy going back to 2014 when I sort of started doing my channel full-time, and the Islamic State was making a big splash back then with a lot of videos of killing people. And I've had a very firm policy simply not looking at any of that. I consume a lot of my news still through Twitter, and I'm quite good at simply closing my eyes and not... I don't look at footage of any kind of footage coming out of Gaza. It's not actually useful for any kind of determination. I mean, anything can be very subjectified. And the only thing that looking at dead bodies from Gaza would do would be to make my mindset even worse than it already is. It's quite depressing enough to read the stories and have a sort of literary concept of what's going on there. I don't feel that I need to look at the dismembered bodies of children or the starving children imagery that is certainly constantly on offer. I'm already angry enough. Thank you very much. Perhaps for some that is useful to have that imagery provided, and perhaps some need that. I don't think that is conducive to a sensible analysis. So basically, to answer your question, I sort of guard myself from the imagery, but the reading about it is quite disturbing enough. As far as following it day to day, no, I do not like dive into, you know, how is Israel progressing along this or that corridor, and which hospital are they blowing up today? That's not really, I don't see much value in that. It's following things in the aggregate. And also, we don't know what's going on in Gaza at all because the Israelis refuse to let any journalists through.
And quite a lot of the ones that do go through get killed.
Yes, a quite intentional and concerted, even before October 7th, a quite intentional and concerted policy of murdering journalists. Even an American citizen about a year ago who was murdered by the Israeli military long before October 7th. But I think since October 7th, it's well over. And it was interesting. I was in Vietnam recently, and I was in there was a display in the War Remnants Museum in Hanoi talking about all of the many foreign correspondents that were killed in Vietnam. And the number... they had two separate numbers. It was kind of interesting. I think perhaps one was the foreign correspondents, and then they had added in a number to include Vietnamese correspondents that had been killed. So it was like something like, so it was 100. The larger number, the smaller number was 77. The larger number was 140. This is 140 journalists killed over 20 years of war.
In one of the most infamous wars of the 20th century.
Yes, this is in both the French and American eras of the Vietnam War. So this is going from the 1950s through the entirety of the 1960s and the 1970s, about 150 people killed, 150 journalists killed. The past 6 months of war in Gaza, my understanding is we are closing in on 200 journalists killed.
Yeah, well, I'm seeing reports here, definitely at least 103.
Oh, 103, is that where we're at? Okay, so I guess I apologize.
Killed in 150 days. And that recording, we're at day 181.
Yeah, 180 days in, and we're at two-thirds as many journalists killed as in 25 years of war in Vietnam. It is just one small indicator of what an extreme and horrific set of circumstances we're dealing with here. And the obfuscation is systematic. If you get your news from cable news or network news in the United States, just nobody's even thinking about this math. Nobody's even raising this question. I do think we are reaching a point. I would certainly wouldn't go so far as to describe anything as hopeful at this point, 6 months into this conflict. But I do think, despite the incredible efforts, despite the digital McCarthyism, despite the very concerted effort of people going from the president of the United States to people in power across the media and government sphere in the United States, despite all of that, I think we are reaching a point, as of this recording, of pretty widespread fatigue and horror at what is being done here in Israel's name and with the United States' approval and money. I think the extent of the moral stain is becoming clearer and clearer. Where we stand right now is, my understanding is, this is a limited understanding, is that there's actually been a fair amount of pullback of Israeli forces at this moment. I think in response to some of the events of the past couple of weeks, in part, but also in part so that they can marshal forces for new horrific offensive that they want to undertake. And I think it's possible, entirely possible, that by the time this is uploaded, this will sound like a forlorn hope and a sad naivete. But it is possible that because of the fortuitous accident, horrifically fortuitous accident of the Israeli Defense Forces' savagery managing to kill a bunch of white people, it's entirely possible that this pullback in preparation for the Rafah offensive may end up just being a pullback. And that would be extraordinary, but that is nothing to rely upon. And it's entirely possible that by the time this is uploaded, we'll be talking about an entirely new era of savagery and destruction.
Phase of the war.
Yeah. I think there's a couple really sort of basic things that are worth pointing out here. There was kind of a absurd poll result came out a couple weeks back talking about the fact that something like half of Americans polled, or maybe it was just 25%, didn't know that more Palestinians had died in this conflict than Israelis.
Wow, that's incredible.
Which is kind of an extraordinary thing here. On October 7th, there was a horrific attack carried out by the terrorist organization Hamas that killed 1,200 Israelis. In the time since, I believe the Israelis...
Yes, injured 5,400.
Yeah. In the time since, I believe the Israeli government has been somewhat cagey about the numbers, but I think it's significantly under 1,000 Israeli soldiers have died. The current generally accepted number of deaths in Gaza is 32,000 or something along those lines. And not just
The UN has come out with 32,000, which is still, the UN's not known for being quick.
Yeah. You can find articles not in crazy lefty outlets or Palestinian affiliated leftist outfits, but in places like the New York Times, which have been notably overly sympathetic to Israeli interpretations of events, have pointed out that in fact that 32,000 number is incredibly low, because most of the medical facilities in Gaza that were putting together more reliable numbers have been targeted and destroyed by Israel. So the people who are actually recording the numbers are a lot thinner on the ground. And additionally, this is sort of pretty generally acknowledged, because the Gaza Health Ministry's numbers are fairly rigorous, they only record the deaths of people that they have actually seen the bodies of. When you consider the fact that wide swaths of Gaza have been leveled and there are bodies within those structures, that have not been recovered. It is very easy to conclude at this point that somewhere along the lines of 40,000 or even 50,000 Gazans have been killed. This is an extraordinarily lethal event. I believe the numbers of civilians killed in 20 years of U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, I believe the amounts of civilians killed by the U.S. military are significantly lower than that. In Iraq, there were some particularly horrific months. I'm thinking the shock and awe initial invasion of Iraq by the United States. Tens of thousands of Iraqis were killed in that, in, you know, 1 month there. But in the aggregate, the sort of 6 months of horror we've seen in Gaza is far outpaces really anything that anybody has done. You have to look to African countries of tens or even 100 million, the war in Ethiopia, the war in Sudan, to get at numbers anywhere near on this same level. But those are conflicts that involve mass starvation, a very different kind of conflict. It is not the sort of pure death from above by a massively more capable enemy that we've seen between Israel and Gaza.
According to gov.israel, 260 Israeli soldiers have been killed in the ground offensive in Gaza.
Okay, so we've got at most 1,500 Israelis killed and potentially 50,000 Gazans killed over the course of this conflict.
I remember when we first reported on this, there was a quote of Benjamin Netanyahu claiming that he wants to, like, a 20-to-1 death ratio for every Israeli killed. And I felt sort of uncomfortable repeating that, like it was a gross mm-hmm. exaggeration. But at this point, it's a understatement.
No, we're at 25-to-1, if not significantly higher. The point at which I became comfortable referring to this as a genocide, it's not related to the incredible mismatch in deaths. It's not related to the horrific terror bombing that I believe was more intense in the earlier months of this conflict. It is the concerted policy between the United States and Israel of mass starvation. I believe we've talked about this before to some extent. The UN WRA, it is a UN organization that is responsible for feeding of the Palestinians. At about almost, I think, the exact day, or was it the same week that the ICJ provided a ruling that it was plausible that Israel was committing genocide, Israel launched a new aspect.
265,000 people facing critical levels of food insecurity. 854,000 people facing emergency levels of food insecurity. And 1.1 million people facing catastrophic levels of food insecurity. That's just essentially the vast majority of people in Gaza are either starving or incredibly hungry.
And in, I believe it was December or January, Israel decided to launch a smear campaign against the agency that feeds them. And to our eternal shame, the United States jumped in as well and decided to pull out funding. So we already had a food insecurity crisis. And then 3 months ago, the United States defunded the agency that feeds the Palestinians. This is the point at which I no longer had any qualms about applying the word genocide to what we're doing here. So the conflict shifted from...
All water treatment systems are non-operational.
Yeah.
So no sewage or anything is getting processed at this point?
Yeah. This is the point at which I became comfortable using the word genocide, because that does appear to be the actual plan of the Israeli and U.S. governments here. And it's incredibly horrifying.
28 children died from malnutrition or dehydration at this point. But as I say, the UN's famously slow. These are all from the UN themselves.
Those numbers are very likely to rise
31% of children under the age of 2 in northern Gaza suffering from acute malnutrition.
One of the most telling comments for me was from a guy named Alex DeWall. I believe it's Alex DeWall, who is almost the expert, or at least the sort of Western expert on famine and conflict in the Horn of Africa. He literally wrote not the book, but multiple books on the Darfur genocide, warfare in Sudan. I became aware of him as sort of a go-to source of information during the Ethiopian war between 2020 and 2022. And he has come out and said he has never seen anything worse than what is happening in Gaza right now. The phase that we're in right now is less the high volume, and don't get me wrong, high volume horrific bombing attacks are continuing to occur. But what's being done to the population of Gaza right now is a concerted plot of mass starvation and vulnerability to diseases. It is quite extreme. And I think just to emphasize the distinction between what's happening here and what happened in Yemen, what is happening in Sudan right now, what is happening in Ethiopia, is that these are incredibly, you know, Yemen, Sudan, Ethiopia, incredibly impoverished places where absolutely political actors have made choices that made things worse. These are in places with a baseline of precarity, just the very nature of existence in these places, in part due to 20, you know, decades of war and insecurity, are much more fragile. There is no fragility to getting people food in Gaza. It's very straightforward.
But in somewhere like Sudan, the two sides, it's almost a fair fight. That's what's... Well, this, it feels like it's just you could turn it off tomorrow if you wanted.
Exactly. And one of the most disturbing things is that we have an illustration of that. That's exactly my point, is that, like, those are wars. This is a program of extermination in one of the, as the Israelis love telling you, in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It is a concerted plan of starving to death people who are not citizens but subjects of one of the richest countries in the world. And that is the why I get so angry when people are like, well, you know, there was starvation and disease in Yemen and Sudan and Ethiopia as well. Yeah, but that wasn't like... And, you know, in some of those places, that was the plan as well. But as you said, it was in the context of a war, of actual dispute between political actors, to which there was some question.
And quite often, the old saying about a war is you can choose when to start a war, but not when to end it. So I'm sure once, you know, these actors chose to go down this path, they can't just say, oh, no, let's just call it even. Like, but this is just a completely different thing entirely. Whatever this is. And very rarely do you ever hear, we know when people argue, is something a genocide, is something not a genocide? Like, very rarely does it not involve just lots of innocent dying.
Yeah, I had a discussion at some point this week with a sort of fairly fervent somewhat ignorant Israel supporter. And it's interesting the extent to which this guy emphasized that, oh no, this is existential. If Israel doesn't go into Rafah, then Israel's not going to survive. And it's lunacy. You've actually got, when I eventually make a produced video on this, I believe it's, I can't remember which one it is, but it is a former Israeli prime minister who simply came out very straightforwardly, and I think this was as early as November, saying,
you know, Israel is not under existential threat.
This is emphatically not an existential fight for the Israelis. This is not something that actually, there was no question October 7th was a horrific crime that took place because the Netanyahu government was more interested in using the Israeli military to antagonize the Palestinians in the West Bank who wanted to work with Israel than they were in watching the Hamas elements that were quite openly committed to extermination. So this is a terrible Israeli mishap, but that involves absolutely no real threat to Israel when the Israeli government is competent and actually paying attention. But it's to believe that you can continue carrying out this program of extermination, you have to fool yourself into believing that Israel is in some kind of danger. Were Israel in some kind of danger, the kind of danger that the Israeli government is working very hard right now to manufacture by trying to start a war with Iran, if Israel were in serious danger, then what the Israeli government is doing in Gaza would still be horrific and unforgivable, but it would be understandable to some degree. Where most importantly, it would be understandable to the degree that the U.S. political system would provide even less resistance than it has. But to that question of, you know, how inevitable is this? You know, Israel's hands are tied. It's not Israel's fault that people are starving. It's Hamas's fault that people are starving. Well, we got a really concrete answer to that question, to that issue, in the events of April 1st and the aftermath. A group of aid workers from World Central Kitchen, I believe is the organization, were attempting to provide aid on approved Israel Defense Forces approved routes that they had cleared with the Israeli Defense Forces ahead of time in clearly marked World Central Kitchen vehicles, and they were massacred. 7 aid workers were killed. Crucially, they were, or at least a significant portion of them, were white people. You had a 1 U.S.-Canadian national and 3 British nationals among these aid workers and their security team were killed. And that, unlike the 30,000-plus Gazans, 10,000-plus children that have been murdered, this made waves. This had an impact. And very quickly, the most important player in this ongoing genocide, Joe Biden, felt that he had to actually, instead of providing these sort of on background, oh gosh, Joe Biden's so angry, he's just broken up, he's so sad, he really wants Netanyahu to do more stories that we've been getting since October, he actually had a stern phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu. And immediately, a whole bunch of crossings that couldn't possibly be opened were opened, and barely 100 aid trucks that were going in a day instantly jumped up to 300, 400 aid trucks a day. Because that's all that Joe Biden ever had to do, was raise his voice slightly to Netanyahu. And I think it's great that for a brief period of time, probably already shut down, there were more aid trucks going into Gaza, but it's chilling to have it so openly illustrated how nonsensical and fraudulent all those stories about how much Joe Biden cares and how disturbed Joe Biden is, to have that revealed with such obviousness. In fact, Joe Biden could have stopped this at any point. In fact, Joe Biden could have alleviated this suffering at any point, chose to do so briefly because a few too many white people got killed one time. And that, I think that's a really important detail and telling detail about this conflict that has not been covered adequately.
But I think that might bring us on to the whole, the terrifying factor of how AI is being used in this conflict and how targets seem to just be everyone that's not a woman is thumbs up.
Yeah, this was certainly, you know, it's very strange looking at this conflict versus looking at U.S. drone warfare, U.S. counter-ISIS approaches, the U.S. war on terror generally, and being in the very rare position to say, gosh, you gotta hand it to the U.S. drone war. Because compared to what Israel is doing, it is just shockingly humane. I think there's this assumption that the Israeli military has the same principles and the same approach that the U.S. military has in its ongoing war on terror, and that is not the case.
So if I'm correct, the U.S., the way they use drones, so I think these would be sort of like, these are top-tier drones that cost, you know, over a million, and they're about the size of a small plane. And what they'll do is basically monitor. They have a station, isn't it, in Texas? And they monitor, you know, an individual. They'll see when they leave. They see when they go to the shop. They see when they buy such and such. And once they've gathered enough information, they'll get, say, a plus one or a plus two, depending on how valuable the target is. So a plus one or plus two means you're allowed to kill them plus one or two civilians. So it's generally very rare, as it say, more than five. If it's super high target, you can kill everyone in the car. So you'll have a gun usually, or maybe a rocket on this, and you know, you're stalking them for days, and then one day you get, right, they're going to be here. They're only with their daughter. That's sad, but we're killing this one person. And what's very interesting about this is it seems like it's warfare's come full circle. While these people seem to get horrendous post-traumatic stress disorder, there seem to be a thing that, you know, the closer to the battle you are, the more distressed you get.
The guys pulling the trigger have the...
So, and normally the further away you get, you know, the less impact it had. So in Vietnam, you had soldiers that are pilots that were dropping bombs, which were doing horrific things, but they'd be casually chatting, playing to music, and they very rarely had many of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress. But now it's like we've come all the way back around. So these are people literally in another continent in Texas, but they feel horrific because they essentially know this person. They know their family. They know their routine. And then one day it's like they made it all disappear. So that's kind of how the drone warfare works. But this just was like, I don't know, you've just read about something. From what I can tell, this AI, it's weird how it's both incredibly high-tech and low-tech, because the AI doesn't know where they are. It seems to use phone calls. It's basically using phone calls, scrambling through them and saying, this person's a baddie, kill them. But they don't know where they are. So often the missiles just go to the house. But quite often people sell phones because, you know, just to give a heads up, India made a phone 5 years ago that cost a dollar. Everyone has smartphones now. They're not a luxury item. Like, I'd say, you know, people in the poorest countries in the world have smartphones now. But people sell phones, they give phones, they leave them places. So quite often it's like, if a phone's been given to a family member, well, they're just going to be rocketed and everyone dies. But it's also just the fact, like, I've heard, well, I talked about the analogy earlier where you get a plus one or a plus two. They were getting like plus 100, and it's just like, oh, well. And they weren't even like potentially that high ranked.
One of the revelations from this quite horrific article in, I think it's 972 magazine, which has done a lot of pretty groundbreaking reporting on
this
conflict.
It's an Israeli magazine. I think that's the area code for Israel. That's where the name comes from.
Well, the extraordinary thing is that's the area code for Israel and Palestine. Which is a,
oh,
I think, a,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is another sort of indication of just, and so this story made incredible waves for a wide variety of revelations. So you'd mentioned there's the plus one, plus two. I think it goes higher, but in the United States, but you need approval of lawyers, and if you get more than like a plus one or plus two, you need to, you know, generals need to be signing off on that. It was revealed in this 972 article that for a low-level Hamas fighter, not even a target, a big guy, a coordinator, a leader, for a fighter, the acceptable ratio of dead civilians is 15 to 20 civilians. So basically, it's okay in Israeli books to murder 15 to 20 civilians to take out, like, you know, Mohammed Shmo, you know, who might pick up an AK-47. For a high level, for a high ranked target, it is acceptable, according to Israeli weapons systems, to murder 100 people, 100 civilians for a high level target. It is nuts. But I think that doesn't give the full picture of just how horrifying this is. I think we've become familiar with just things like ChatGPT or whatnot, the degree to which these AI systems can hallucinate, can sort of. I'm sure I'm comparing apples to oranges by talking about ML, whatever. These are fallible technologies that are being unleashed on a mass scale, simply saying, according to all of this data that we've sucked up, these individuals might, you know, probably, there's like a 90% chance that this person is affiliated with Hamas to some extent. We don't know. We're not checking any of this. Apparently, the only check they have before between the AI machine spitting out a name and a target is, are they not a woman? You know, as long as they're male, they die.
Yes.
According to a mass AI system.
So I get to imagine there's some like 19-year-old that basically gets a recording and it's like, is this a man or a woman? And basically you're saying, are they going to die?
Yeah.
They're a woman. Yeah. Okay, don't kill them. And then you get another message. They're a man. And then, because it seemed to be very low ranking people giving the authority to activate these rockets.
Yeah. It's basically, and I did get the sense from the article that this was more like the early months of the conflict, and they may have backed off this approach a little bit. But you just...
Do you know why they backed off in the later months, Rob?
No.
Because they can't track in real time, or it's difficult to track in real time where they are, they were just bombing the houses. But because the place is just rubble now, there aren't any houses to bomb anymore.
Wow.
It just kind of blew my mind. It's like, they've destroyed so much, they can't even use the AI anymore.
It's horrifying.
They just give them open season.
One aspect of this, and I think this is to the name of the magazine, that is, you know, Israel and Palestine, they have one area code. One of the reasons that we have full spectrum horror of this AI machine for mass murder is because of the amount of data that Israel has. Because again, these Palestinians are not foreigners. It's not Mexico or Canada. It's not a foreign country. They are Israeli
it's
subjects.
It's not Egypt.
they have ID numbers. They have, to the extent that these are individuals that are seen by a state, Israel has that information and generates probably most of that information. And I think that's just another aspect of the horror of this artificial intelligence war on Gaza.
They seem to have recordings of the phone call, so that was it would suggest to me that every phone call that goes on in Gaza, Israel has access to.
Yes, that I don't think that should be surprising.
And the other thing you're talking about, the hallucinations, it said people that act like they were in a military, like police officers or aid workers, then also get targeted.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a monstrous story. I'd recommend people checking out, and there's a reason why people are flipping out about it. But it's only just one of, I mean, just any given week of this conflict has revelations of this caliber. In separate reporting, I think this was Haaretz, sort of revealed that much of Gaza is divided up into kill zones, where if anybody walks in there, they're killed, and then they are just automatically defined as a militant, regardless of whether they were armed or doing anything.
The old classic is any adult male is a terrorist.
Yeah. And the United States,
which I think America used during the war on terror.
The United States did this as well, but this was in the context of a drone war that was killing maybe 100 people a month or something along those lines. And if there were males, you know, who were collateral damage, they were defined as militants, regardless of whether there was any evidence for that. And that was rightly a horrific scandal. But we're talking about, I think we're now talking about how, actually things are kind of subsiding to a lower level in Gaza because only 100 people are being murdered a day. A day. Yeah, it's incredibly distasteful. I wish I had more to say other than to be appalled, but that
this is horrific, and I wish it would stop.
Yes, and it is.
Yeah, the name of this AI is Lavender.
This is utterly pointless. There is no military solution to Hamas. I think it's worth emphasizing, and I don't understand why this isn't more emphasized, how useless this war is in returning hostages. As we've made clear, was against this punitive expedition to Gaza from the start, but it was obvious in October that there was no question that Israel was going to go in here. I recognized the political necessity of that, though I saw the pointlessness of it from the get-go. There's a world where Israel had sane governance, where the November 24th ceasefire continued. Between November 24th and November 30th, after a solid month and a half of horrific bombing of Gaza, the sorts of things we're discussing here, My understanding is that fully, you know, in that month and a half, Israel had achieved its 10 times more Palestinians killed than Israelis, which is unfortunately sort of the standard thing. So, I mean, it's tremendously horrific. At November 24th, we got a ceasefire and negotiations started between Israel and Hamas for the return of hostages. Over those 6 days, 105 hostages were returned. In the initial attack on October 7th, I've seen different numbers, but it's somewhere between 240 and 250 hostages were taken on October 7th. In those 6 days of ceasefire, 105 of those hostages were returned. And there was every potential for that process to continue. Had that ceasefire continued and continued to be extended, I would imagine that most of the 100, well, probably less than 100 remaining hostages would be returned. The entire story and history of Israel's violent assault on Gaza has, I think, returned two hostages. I think they have successfully returned two hostages alive through violent attacks versus 100 hostages returned by ceasefire. So this whole like, oh, we're doing this for the hostages. We must bring them home. Well, if you want to bring these hostages home, you need a ceasefire.
And didn't they admit to killing two or three?
Oh, yeah. So that was the horrific story of a month or two back where three Israeli hostages waving a white flag, I think some of them shirtless, were shot down because that's just the Israeli policy for treating young men in Gaza. Yeah. They had been freed somehow and were running towards Israeli lines, no doubt gleeful and happy to be finally released from their horrific captivity, and they were gunned down by the Israeli Defense Forces. And those are only those three are only the Israeli hostages killed by Israeli bombs and guns that we know about. One of the saddest stories, I think, coming out over the past day as of this recording is the fact that Hamas isn't sure that it can find 40 hostages for a prisoner exchange. This does not mean that of the 130 hostages that were supposed to be left, that all of them are dead or 90 of them are dead. It's for the first stage of a ceasefire that is being negotiated between Israel and Hamas. There's a certain categories of hostages that are meant to be released, elderly men, women, this, that, the other thing. And it has been revealed that Hamas is not confident that it can find 40 such hostages, even though on the list of hostages, there are 40 such. So it is, in the context of Gaza, which is being indiscriminately bombed, it is unquestionable that at least a handful and possibly many more than a handful of these Israeli hostages have been killed by Israeli bombs, because it's not about the hostages.
Another horrific thing I heard was a couple of years ago, three Israelis were kidnapped, but they were killed. But the Israeli Defense Force knew they were dead, but didn't release it to the public because it gave them an excuse to do a lot of killing, essentially. So I just worry that maybe some or all of these remaining hostages are dead, but they're just not saying so as an excuse to, keep the killing going.
Well, I don't think they're all dead, but there are certainly, I mean, as the story today indicates, more of them are dead. More of them are dead than Hamas wants to admit, because these are bargaining chips for Hamas, even though the Israeli government doesn't actually seem that interested in returning them alive.
I'm surprised at how little Hamas's demands are not talked about. They want basically a lot of who are referred to as prisoners. Is it a couple of thousand? Now, you may say prisoners have committed a crime, but a lot of these people, it would seem, haven't. So you could see them as hostages themselves. They want sort of a prisoner exchange, you could talk about, or a hostage exchange. But you never hear the cliche of mainstream media, but it's never like, let's look at this side of things. Let's look at who does Israel have in prison? Because apparently a lot of them are juveniles as well. Like, It just feels like, oh, they have the hostages, so we have to kill all the children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it is insane, frankly. And the degree to which these questions are just unexamined, we've had a, there's now a whole genre of U.S. congresspeople saying incredibly ignorant and bigoted stuff. I think there was actually a U.S. representative in recent weeks saying that we should nuke Gaza, which is, you know, insane on a number of levels.
Yeah, I think I heard that. I don't think they know how nuclear weapons work.
No. Well, a lot of representatives don't know much at all. But it's just the incredible callousness and lack of regard for basic humanity is really just on this scale. Like, yeah, we all know that, like, U.S. politics are racist, you know, nobody cares about people of color, this, that, and the other thing. But to see it on this scale and the viciousness and the bloodlust around it is quite extraordinary. There's this standard reply, I think it's finally fading on YouTube or whatnot, of just like, well, if Hamas would just surrender and turn over all the hostages, then we'd stop killing all these children. And it's like, that's not an argument that makes you look very good. That's a war crime. Like that argument, like, Israel can't come out straight out and say that that's what their goal is, because that would be a war crime. Like, that's called collective punishment. That is not something you're allowed to do under the laws of war.
But it kind of feels like, say you had someone hostage, Rob, and mm-hmm. I just started shooting all your neighbors.
Yeah.
And it's like, better let that hostage go. It's just sort of, I don't know, terrifying lunacy.
Yes. No, it's insane. And what's extraordinary is the extent to which it's mystifying to people when you bring this up. There have been signs in recent weeks, hopeful signs, that we're kind of moving beyond this a bit. I think it's possible. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm saying it's possible that we won't have an offensive in Rafah. It's worth mentioning, so this is Rafah, where over 1 million Gazans are now seeking refuge because they were forced down there by the Israeli military. And now the Israeli military...
Along the Egyptian border.
Yeah, it's along the Egyptian border. Now the Israeli military is saying, sorry, now we've got to go in and do to that place where 1 million people are living what we did to the rest of Gaza. Those are the stakes right now. That is what Netanyahu, I think, in recent days has announced. We've set a date. We're going to do this. And I think there needs to be... Joe Biden, if Joe Biden wants to, he can tell him not to do that, and he will not be able to do that. But Joe Biden has to be convinced. And I think that effort of convincing him may be happening. I think the most important things worth mentioning, we haven't mentioned yet, have got to be the results in the primaries for the Democratic nomination for president. This is not a open contest. It has not been at any point. There were a couple challengers to Biden that nobody takes very seriously. However, he has, in state after state, failed to earn more than 90% of the vote because of I think it's called the uncommitted movement more broadly, though there are different dynamics in every state because, of course, the U.S. electoral system is a complete mess. But it is a movement of, it seems like in multiple states now, over a dozen states at this point, over 10% of the electorate has simply either handed in a blank ballot or filled in the bubble for uncommitted or whatever is relevant in that state. It's becoming illustrated to Joe Biden that 10 to 20% of his electorate is fed up with this and is no longer going to accept this. And I think that's probably making an impression, because especially in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, losing that 10% of his vote means that he doesn't get to be president again. So I think that's having an impact.
But also, aren't young people, say, you know, under 30s, massively in favor of Palestine because, you know, they watch things like TikTok where Israeli soldiers show the day in the life? Because I remember hearing an American senator basically saying, this used to be a left and a right thing. It's not anymore. It's a young and old thing. You know, he was almost sounding a bit radical, like we have to really go out of our way to make sure the young don't support Palestine. They have to support Israel. It's like the most important thing in the world. It sounds just sort of terrifying. Like, our youth have turned against us. They've gone communist because they don't want to watch a bunch of children being murdered.
Well, what's interesting is the extent to which Israel has resurrected the cause of Palestine through this conflict. We talked about, if you go back to our first episode on this in the aftermath of the October 7th attacks, we talked a fair amount about how the cause of Palestine was sort of becoming passé. You have India is no longer interested. The whole great era of decolonization has sort of passed. I mean, you have people who've now lived their whole lives out from under European empire, so that affinity with Palestine is no longer quite so direct. Israel was really getting to a point where if we can just sort of keep the status quo going for another couple decades, there will be no sympathy left for these folks at all. Israel has massively resurrected sympathy for Palestine through these horrific crimes against humanity that they've been committing. The sheer scale of death and abuse is quite extraordinary. And what that's done for the cause of Palestine is massive. Now, I don't know whether 50 years from now, those Palestinians are going to be centering their resistance from Cairo or something along those lines. But I am much more confident now than I was on October 6th that there will be a Palestinian cause 50 years from now, making very similar arguments against Israel. And I think that, people talk a lot about how, the United States is subservient to Israel, this, that, and the other thing. It's like, well, Israel's interests are not being served. Nothing, very little in the Netanyahu administration has done anything for Israel. It's done a lot for U.S. weapons companies, that's for sure. But it has done nothing for the long-term cause of Israel. And I think that's probably as good a note as any to end with. Just the in the most horrific way possible.
Are you seeing any hope? Is there anything you consider to be like, this could be the end and possibly something good could come of this horrendous situation?
Well, those poor aid workers for World Central Kitchen do seem, it's possible, this could seem laughable listening to this from a month from now, but it does seem possible that they may have provided sort of an inflection point. Because there's so much supporting them coming from behind. There's the revolt of Biden's voters. There's the growing realization across Europe, even among countries that were very supportive of Israel in October, that, oh God, this is horrible. These sort of combination of factors, and it's possible, it's within the realm of imagination. I'm not saying it's likely, but it's possible.
So I think when you look into the detail, was there not like a rescue team that basically says, we're going to rescue these ones, and they told the Israelis, and they got bombed as well? So incredibly cruel and malice.
It was a three-part, there were three separate cars, and they were destroyed in three separate strikes as each of them went to the aid of the other people. There was no question from the get-go. If this were just one strike, Israel would have probably made a more concerted effort to describe it as some kind of error or mishap, or Hamas did it. But it was just so blindingly obvious.
Because even ones that seem to support Israel, because there's a radio presenter called, is it Nick Ferrari? And he was basically, he came in one morning very early and he says, I'm just going to read everything on this. And he basically was like, I can't, support Israel really anymore because, well, the big argument in the UK is, should they be selling weapons to Israel? And it's they're saying, there's no evidence to say that they were British weapons, but there's no evidence to say that they weren't or they were. It's just like, so even people that would have been sort of, just supporting the government line, so that's just support Israel, are now basically like, they can't really muster that support for it anymore.
So honestly, one of the most hopeful things that I saw in the past week was actually a Jon Stewart clip. I'd complained quite volubly. I don't know if it was on this. I think we did an episode on Jon Stewart a couple weeks back, but it was before he'd finally addressed the Israel-Palestine conflict. And in his first main monologue, I don't know if it was a month ago at this point, he addressed the Israel-Palestine conflict, and it was incredibly disappointing. Like, it was, he was just sort of like, this is bad, and maybe a ceasefire would be good.
I think he was still trying to make it out like...
sort of both sides are bad.
He was sort of making it out like they were two equal sides. Yeah.
Yes. And he was like, the UN is useless. And it was, you know, it was kind of funny and cute in the John Stewart way, but it was honestly kind of enraging. In the aftermath of the World Central Kitchen bombing, he did a very different sort of bit, which you can find online, and it is markedly different, talking about basically doing kind of brilliant work, doing compare and contrast of the U.S. government's attitude towards actions that the Russian government takes in Ukraine versus very similar or worse actions that the Israeli government is undertaking in Gaza.
We also condemn the Russian government's continued targeting and repression of journalists.
You hear that, Russia? We condemn, in no uncertain terms, any repression of a free press. I think you all know what's coming next. More journalists have been killed in Gaza in 6 months than anywhere else in the world. And a new Israeli law says they can ban media outlets they consider a threat.
And I do think it's... Now, I don't want to say, like, John Stewart has always been attempted to be fair-minded and not, like, unthinkingly a supporter of Israel. It's just the water that he swims in U.S. media is many of those things. But to see him going from that sort of temporizing, both-sidesing, to, like, actually seriously turning a critical eye towards what Israel's doing right now was very heartening to see, and I think might be an indication of a broader shift. And God, is it overdue. It would be nice if that shift came 5 months ago or 6 months ago instead of after what is definitely 32,000 and probably 50,000 deaths. That's where we are, and we...
1.7 million people displaced.
Where we continue to be.
Stay safe. We wish you all the very best from the More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Indeed.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.